William Whiston, born in 1667, published in 1696 his new theory of the Earth. In this book he claimed that the comet of 1682 was of a 575.5-year periodicity, that the same comet had appeared in February of 1106, in plus 531 in the consulate of Lampadius and Orestes, and in September of minus 44, the year of Caesar's assassination. Whiston further asserted that this comet had met the Earth in minus 2346, and caused the deluge. Whiston found in classical literature references to the change in inclination of the terrestrial axis and, ascribing it to a displacement of the poles by the comet of the deluge, concluded that before this catastrophe the planes of daily rotation and yearly revolution coincided and that, therefore, there had been no seasons. He also found references to a year consisting of 360 days only, and although the Greek authors referred the change to the time of Atreus and Thyestes, and the Romans to the time of Numa, Car, minus 700, Whiston ascribed these changes to the effect of the Earth's encounter with the comet of the deluge. Whiston thought that the Earth itself was once a comet. Whiston was chosen by Isaac Newton to take over his chair of mathematics at Trinity College in Cambridge when Newton, after many years, retired in order to dedicate himself to the duties of the president of the Royal Society. Whiston, like Newton, was a Unitarian. He was also close to being a fundamentalist. He was certain that only one global catastrophe was described in the scripture, that of the deluge. Of the phenomenon described in the book of Joshua, he wrote, "The scripture did not intend to teach men philosophy, or accommodate itself to the true and Pythagoric system of the world." It is difficult to say what caused Newton, who selected Whiston as his successor, to oppose Whiston's election to the membership of the Royal Society. We have another similar instance a century later, when Sir Humphrey Davy, the mentor of Michael Faraday, conducted a strenuous campaign to keep Faraday from being admitted to the Royal Society, of which Davy was president. But the very idea of a periodicity of comets, gleaned by Whiston from Halley, was not yet accepted. In 1744, a German author wrote, "It is well known that Whiston and others like him who wish to predict the comings and goings of comets, deceive themselves, and have become an object of ridicule by the entire world." Still later, Whiston was ridiculed by Georges Cuvier, himself a proponent of a catastrophist theory. Whiston fancied that the Earth was created from the atmosphere of one comet, and that it was deluged by the tail of another. The heat which remained from its first origin, in his opinion, excited the whole antediluvian population, men and animals, to sin, for which they were all drowned in the deluge, excepting the fish, whose passions were apparently less violent. References is not read up here. See the original books by search on pdfarchive.info, and Velikovsky. Deluge and comet. The idea that a comet heralded the deluge was not new with William Whiston. It is found in several earlier authors, the so-called comptographers and chronologists of the 17th century. But they only described the appearance of the comet at the time of the deluge as a matter of fact, and did not deduce any theory from it. No causal relation was seen. It was more in the nature of a coincidence. New in Whiston was the identification of the comet of 1680 as the comet of the deluge, and the perturbatory effects on the position and motion of our planet, ascribed by him to the activities of the comet. Finally, his general theory that the Earth itself was once a comet. The author whom Whiston names as his source was J. Hevelius, whose Comptographia was published in 1668. Apparently Whiston did not go further back to the sources of Hevelius, to Abraham Rockenbach, 15-16, Seth Galvisius, 1556-1615, Henricus Extormius, Christopher Helvicus, 1581-1617, and David Herlesius, 1557-1636. Abraham Rockenbach was a scholar of the late Renaissance, a man of broad interests, already evident from that fact that he occupied both the chair of Greek and of mathematics at the University of Frankfurt, and later taught law and became dean of the philosophical college at that university. In 1602 he published a short treatise in Latin, De Comitatis Tractatus Novus Methodicus, and in it he had the following entry concerning the deluge. In the year of the creation of the world 1656, after Noah had attained the age of 600 years, 3 days before the death of Methusalem, a comet appeared in the constellation Pisces, was seen by the entire world as it traversed the 12 signs of the zodiac in the space of a month. On the 16th of April it again disappeared. After this the deluge immediately followed, in which all creatures which live on earth and creep on the ground were drowned, with the exception of Noah and the rest of the creatures that had gone with him into the ark. And so about these things is written in Genesis, chapter 7. Rockenbach lived and wrote nearly 100 years before Whiston. What were Rockenbach's sources? He did not let us know. He referred to them at the beginning of his treatise, claiming that it was based on information ex probatissimis and antiquissimis veterum scriptoribus, from the most trustworthy and the most ancient of the early writers. We have already had occasion to quote from Rockenbach in connection with the comet that shone during the Exodus. There he refers only to Pliny, although he probably used other sources besides Lydus, Servius, Heffer Eston. And Junctinus wrote about comets, and Servius mentions also the writings of Campestre and Pitocyrus. Although we may never be certain of the sources on which Abraham Rockenbach and other comptographers drew in mentioning a comet in connection with the deluge, the great medieval rabbinical authority Rashi was probably among them. Rashi wrote concerning Kama, a celestial body mentioned in Job 9-9 and 38 hours 31 minutes, and in Amos 5-8, that it is a star with a tail, or a comet. In the Talmud, Kama is associated with the deluge, and this seems to have been the source of the comptographer's assertion that a comet appeared in conjunction with that event. The question now is, what was Kama, and what was its role in the deluge? Was it really a comet as Rashi thought? Kama. In the tractate Brakot of the Babylonian Talmud it is said that the deluge was caused by two stars that fell from Kama toward the earth. The statement reads, when the Holy One wanted to bring a flood upon the world, he took two stars from Kama and brought a flood upon the world. I have already mentioned that Rashi, the medieval exegete whose authority is unsurpassed among the rabbis, says that in the quoted sentence Kama means a star with a tail, or a comet. This explanation found its way into the works of several Gentile theologians. Should it be understood so that two large meteorites fell from a comet and falling on earth caused tidal waves? Instances when meteorites fell while a comet was glowing in the sky are known, and the classic case is found in Aristotle. Should a meteorite equal in mass to the one which by its impact formed the Arizona crater fall into the ocean, tidal waves of the widespread would result, possibly circling the globe. Then are we to understand the deluge as a huge tidal wave rushing across the continents? This picture differs widely from the story in Genesis, according to which water was falling for a long period from the sky and the waters of the depths rose, covering the surface of the earth. The tractate Brakot so explicitly points to the cause of the deluge that before classifying the narrative in Genesis in its entirety as folkloristic imagery, which in part it most certainly is, and also before following Rashi's idea any further, we ought to inquire, which celestial body is Kama? Is it correctly explained as a comet? In the Old Testament Kama is mentioned in several instances. In Job, chapter 9, the Lord is he who removes the mountains, and overturns them, and shakes the earth out of her place, which commands the sun and it rises not, which alone spreads the heaven, which makes Sh and Kezel, and Kama, and the chambers of the south. In the King James Version these names are translated as Arcturus, Orion, and Pleiades. Chambers of the south are usually explained as constellations of the south. Kama and Kezel are also named in Job, chapter 38, here again in a text that deals with the violent acts to which the earth was once subjected, who shut up the sea with doors, barriers, when it break forth, as if it had issued out of the womb. Who might take hold of the ends of the earth, that the wicked might be shaken out of it. The Lord asks Job, "Canst thou bind the chains, fetters, of Kimmah and loosen the reins of Gezel? Canst thou lead forth the Matzereth in its season?" Davidson and Lanchester wonder at the meaning of this passage. Like the King James Version, they translate Pleiades for Kimmah and Orion for Gezel. Matzereth is left untranslated. In Amos, chapter 5, once more, Kimmah and Gezel are mentioned in a verse that reveals the great acts of the Lord who makes Kimmah and Gezel, and turns the shadow of death into morning, and makes the day dark with night, that calls for the waters of the sea, and pours them upon the face of the earth. Hieronymus, also known as Saint Jerome, the 4th century author of the Vulgate, the Latin version of the Old Testament, translates Kimmah as Arcturus in one instance, Amos 5, as Pleiades in another, Job 38, and as Hyades in the third, Job 9. The identities of Kimmah and Gezel, Sh and Matzereth, were of lesser importance when it amounted to finding their meaning for their own sake in the poetical sentences of Amos and Job. But such identification, especially of Kimmah, grows in importance if the quoted sentence from the tractate Brachot may contribute to an understanding of the etiology of the deluge, as the ancients knew or thought to know it. In Worlds in Collision, I have already explained that Matzereth signifies the morning, evening, star. The Vulgate has Lucifer for Matzereth, and the Septuagint reads, "Canst thou bring forth Matzereth in his season and guide the evening star by his long hair?" I have already shown why the morning evening star was described as having hair or coma, and why Venus did not appear in its seasons. Apparently the other members of the group were planets, too. And actually we could have started by the disclosure that in the rabbinical literature Kimmah is referred to as Melkimah. In Hebrew, Mel means planet. Then which planet is Kimmah? If we can find out which of the planets is Kimmah, then we may know also to which planet the Talmud assigned the physical cause of the world inundation. As we have seen, the biblical texts by themselves do not contain the means to determine which of the planets Kimmah and Gezel are. Were it not for the heat of Gezel, the world could not endure the cold of Kimmah, and were it not for the cold of Kimmah, the world could not endure the heat of Gezel. This sentence is found, too, in the Babylonian Talmud, in the tractate Brachot. Gezel means in Hebrew fool. From the biblical texts it is not apparent why one of the planets received this adverse name, or why, more probably, the word fool was derived from the name of the planet. In the Iliad, Ares Mars is called fool. Pallas Athena said to him, "Fool, not even yet hast thou learned how much mightier than thou I avow me to be, that thou matchest thy strength with mine." These words explain also why Mars was called fool. It clashed repeatedly with the planet comet Venus, much more massive and stronger than itself. To the peoples of the world, this prolonged combat must have appeared either as a very valiant action on the part of Mars, not resting but coming up again and again to attack the stupendous Venus, or it must have appeared as a foolish action of going again and again against the stronger planet. Homer described the celestial battles as actions of foolishness on the part of Mars. Thus Gezel, or fool, among the planets named in the Old Testament, is most probably Mars. In Pliny we find a sentence which reads, "The star Mars has a fiery glow. Owing to its excessive heat and Saturn's frost, Jupiter being situated between them combines the influence of each and renders it healthy." The heating effect ascribed in the Talmud to Gezel is ascribed by Pliny to Mars, and the cooling effect of Kimmah to Saturn. By this sentence of Pliny we are strengthened in our identification of Gezel as the planet Mars. It corroborates the conclusion we just made with the help of the Iliad. But what is even more important, Pliny helps to identify the planet Kimmah. It is Saturn. Cicero also wrote that Saturn has a cooling influence, whereas Mars imparts heat. Porphyry, an author of the 3rd century, wrote similarly with Pliny and Cicero, "The power of Cronos, Saturn, they perceive to be sluggish and slow and cold. The power of Aries, Mars, they perceive to be fiery." Porphyry's contemporary Plotinus wrote, "When the cold planet, Saturn, is in opposition to the warm planet, Mars, both become harmful." Other statements to the same effect are found in Vitruvius, and Proclus. In these sentences, as in those of Pliny and of the Talmud, Mars is regarded as being a fiery planet, Saturn as being a cold planet. The passage in the Book of Job, 38:31, can now be read, "Canst thou bind the bonds of Saturn and loosen the reins of Mars?" The bonds of Saturn can be seen even today with a small telescope. The reins of Gezel I discussed in Worlds in Collision, section The Steeds of Mars. The two small moons of Mars, Phobos and Deimos, were known to Homer and are mentioned by Virgil. They were regarded by the peoples of antiquity as steeds yoked to Mars' chariot. The passage in the Talmud that makes the planet Canna responsible for the deluge means, two stars erupted from the planet Saturn and caused the deluge. Saturnian comets. Before searching ancient traditions for any possible association of Saturn with the deluge, let us notice that the idea that Saturn may have anything to do with the origin of some of the comets of the solar system is not without a theoretical foundation. A group of short-period comets carries the name of Saturnian family of comets. They revolve on ellipses that approach closely the orbit of Saturn. A larger family of short-period comets carries the name Jovian, and Re-Jupiter is regarded as having something to do with their origin. Their orbits come close to the orbit of Jupiter. The usual explanation for the Saturnian and Jovian families of comets is that they had originally traveled on extremely elongated or even parabolic orbits and, passing close to one of the large planets, were changed into short-period comets, traveling on ellipses. It is usual to say that they were captured. However, the Russian astronomer K. Przegzwiartski of the Kiev Observatory, one of the leading authorities on comets, has brought strong arguments to show that the comets of the solar system are very youthful bodies, only a few thousand years old, and that they originated in explosions from the planets, especially from the major planets Saturn and Jupiter or their moons. By comparing the observed luminosity of the periodic comets on their subsequent returns, he found it failing and their masses rapidly diminishing by loss of matter to the space through which they travel. The head of the comet emits tails on each passage close to the Sun and then dissipates the matter of the tails without recovery. Thus Przegzwiartski concluded that comets of short duration originated in the solar system, were not captured from outside of that system, a point to which the majority of astronomers still adhere, and that they came into existence by explosion from Jupiter and Saturn, and to a smaller extent by explosion from the smaller planets, like Venus and Mars. In order to originate in this manner from a planet, the exploded mass must overcome the gravitational pull of the parent body. The larger the mass of the planet, the greater must be the initial velocity of the exploding matter, the velocity of escape. For this reason, the idea of explosion of comets from the planets is preferred to the idea of their explosion from the Sun. Due to the great mass of the Sun, the velocity of escape from there must be in the approximation of 30 km in the first second, and from Saturn only 35 km. But even these velocities are rather high, so that Professor Przegzwiartski acknowledged that there must have been unusual circumstances which he did not try to determine, but the existence of which he claimed on the basis of the effects produced, namely the short-lived comets reaching to the orbits of Jupiter and Saturn every time these comets recede from the Sun to their farthest points, aphelia. The sentence in the Tractate Brachot that ascribes the cause of the deluge to the cometary bodies that erupted from the planet Saturn no longer appears as fantastic as when we first understood the meaning of comma in that sentence. The explosion of cometary bodies from Saturn and Jupiter is claimed on the basis of purely astronomical observations and calculations. The circumstances of such explosions must have been admittedly extraordinary. The time when this happened must be measured in thousands of years, not tens of thousands or millions. Will we also be able to establish with the help of collective human memory what were the extraordinary conditions? But should we not first, as intended, place ourselves on firmer ground by showing that the statement in the Tractate Brachot is not alone testimony unsupported in the traditions and beliefs of the ancient races of the world? Saturn in the deluge. Following the rabbinical sources which declare that the deluge was caused by two comets ejected by the planet Kimma, and our interpretation of the planet Kimma as Saturn, we begin to understand the astrological texts, such as certain passages in the Tetrabiblos of Ptolemy, which attribute to the planet Saturn floods and all catastrophes caused by high water. The planet's presence in Aquarius especially brought expectations of heavy rains and flooding, as is attested, among others, by the 1st-century Roman author Lucan. Many of the ancient astrologers were in agreement on this point. In a work entitled Speculum Astrologiae, Junctinus ascribes inundations to the action of Saturn's comets. Cuneiform texts contain prophecies of a deluge taking place when a comet assumes a direction with its head towards the Earth. Philosophers of antiquity who were not astrologers also expressed their belief that Saturn is in some way related to moisture, among them the pre-Socratics Philolaus and Philodemus, and, somewhat later, Plato. The elder Pliny wrote in his Natural History that it is well known that heavy rains follow transitions of Saturn. Servius asserted that Saturn is a god of rains. When in the sign of Capricorn, he causes very heavy rains, especially in Italy, and again, Saturn is the god of all that is humid and cold. Proclus recorded the beliefs of the Pythagoreans. Again, in the heavens, Aries is fire, Jupiter air, Cronos water. Nonos referred to ancient Cronos, heavy need, pouring rain. Hippolytus wrote of the beliefs of a member of the Priti sect, but water, he says, is destruction, nor did the world, he says, perish by any other thing quicker than by water. Water, however, they assert, it to be, Cronus. We recognize that the astrological connection between Saturn and catastrophes created by high water has a very ancient origin. In the Titian story of the deluge, as told by Berossos, Cronos, Saturn, disclosed to the king Xisuthros that a universal flood would begin on the 15th of the month Dasios. Abidinos says, Cronos announced to Xisuthros that a flood would pour from above. The light of the 7 days. Isaiah, in describing the days to come, when great changes in nature will take place, says that the earth will give its increase in abundance, and the light of the moon shall be as the light of the sun, and the light of the sun shall be sevenfold, as the light of the 7 days. One could think that the light of the 7 days refers to the 7 days of creation. However, the actual explanation appears to me to be different. The expression "the light of the 7 days" refers, in my view, to the 7 days preceding the flood that are referred to in the verse, "For yet 7 days, and I will cause it to rain upon the earth. And it came to pass after 7 days, that the waters of the flood were upon the earth." Genesis 7, 4, 10. It is not explained in the text, after 7 days of what? But the rabbinical tradition relates that for 7 days before the deluge the people heard a great commotion in the heaven, that signified the end of the age. The Talmudic tradition that often reaches much farther into the past than better known sources, like the books of the scriptures, reveals in this instance a memory not suspected at the reading of the 7th chapter of Genesis. But in view of what we have brought out until now, and what we intend to illuminate on the following pages, the blinding light preceding the deluge by 7 days is an interesting and important detail. The world was in a dazzling light, sevenfold stronger than the light of the sun. The light was so strong and so brilliant day and night alike, that the sun was entirely overpowered by it, and in the days of Isaiah, thousands of years later, the memory of the light of the 7 days was vivid in tradition, so that the prophet could refer to it in desiring to describe the solar light of the Messianic age. Numerous Sanskrit texts assert that 7 or even 12 suns shone just before the deluge. Being ignited, all of a sudden, the entire terrestrial sphere blazed forth. 12 suns shone with dazzling radiance and consumed the world. The Skanda Purana in Shastri, the flood legend in Sanskrit literature, p. 86. Cf. Similar accounts in the Matsya Purana, ch. 2, the Padma Purana, ch. 36, the Vishnu Purana, ch. 3, the Kalika Purana, ch. 25, and in the Mahabharata, chapter Matsya Pakayana. The light of the 7 days was not of solar origin. Of what origin was it? Was it caused by brightly illuminated clouds of ionized hydrogen, or protons, hurled throughout the solar system and poured on Earth? In the latter case, they could have arrived from the present distance of Saturn in about a week, considering that the proton particles, ionized hydrogen, arrive from the Sun in the space of 25 hours. This is the time which elapses from a flare-up on the Sun, protuberance, to the display of the polar lights, the aurora borealis. The light of the 7 days served the population of the world as a warning of some extraordinary events. Hydrogen and oxygen. The conflict between the larger planets resulted in long-stretched filaments ejected by a disturbed Saturn to cross the Earth's orbit. The hydrogen of the planet combined with the oxygen of the terrestrial atmosphere in electrical discharges and turned into water. There are definite indications of a drastic drop in the atmospheric oxygen at the time of the deluge. For instance, the survivors of the catastrophe are said in many sources to have been unable to light fires. The consumption of the oxygen in the air by its conversion into water could not fail to have a marked effect upon all that breathes. The animal life that survived needed to accommodate itself to the changed conditions. According to rabbinical sources, before the deluge man was vegetarian, but the post-diluvian population did not continue the vegetarian habits of the sinful population of the earth. The Talmud and the Midrashim narrate that after the deluge, carnivorous instinct was awakened in animal and man, and everyone had the impulse to bite. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the air. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you, and as I gave you the green plants, I will give you everything. The prohibition against quenching the thirst for blood is an ordinance said to have been introduced immediately after the deluge. In a teleological program, this result of the deluge does not seem appropriate for a catastrophe brought about to chastise the human race and the animals, to cleanse them of their vices and make them better. Because of its non-program appearance, the carnivorous urge must have been not a mythological motif, but a result of physiological changes. Most probably an anemia connected with the diminution of oxygen in the air was responsible for the new inclination. The origin of the oceans. It must have been at the very beginning of my occupation with the problems later developed in my books and in not yet published manuscripts, that I came upon the question of the origin of salts in seas and oceans. The common salt is a substantial ingredient of the oceanic content, or, said differently, the water of the oceans and seas contains a substantial solution of NaCl, or sodium chloride. Even though our blood and tissues abound in sodium chloride, man and animals are not adapted to drink salty water, and life on land could develop only thanks to the evaporation of the water from the surface of seas and oceans, or to distillation. The evaporating water is free from salts, falling as rain or snow or dew. It feeds underground sources and also glaciers, and through them the brooks and rivers and lakes, and is delivered to our use usually through concrete tubes and metal pipes. Of the salts of the seas, sodium chloride is by far the most abundant. The provenance of it is, however, a riddle. It was, and still is, assumed that the salts in the oceans originated mainly through importation from land, having been dissolved from rocks by flowing rivulets and rivers, themselves fed by underground sources, and the same process working on the rocks of the seabed. Terrestrial formations are rich in sodium, and in eons of time, it is assumed, the sodium washed out of the rocks supplied its content to the oceans, the seas evaporate and the concentration of these salts grows. But the rocks are by far not so rich in chlorine, and hence the problem. From where did chlorine come to contribute its abundance to oceanic water? There is chlorine in source water, but usually not in significant amounts. The proportion of salts in the rivers is very different from their proportion in the seas. River water has many carbonates, 80% of the salts, fewer sulfates, 13%, and still fewer chlorides, 7%. Sea water has many chlorides, 89%, fewer sulfates, 10%, and only a few carbonates, 0.2%. The comparison of these figures makes it clear that rivers cannot be made responsible for most of the salts of the seas.